All right, let me just turn on recording. All right, great. All right, welcome everyone. Chag Sameach, and Reshut Roitman. So the topic we'll be scoring tonight is going to be a very the MISA topic this year, although as I understand it's not really relevant for well, very obviously since it, at Plainview, but it is in some other places, as to whether or not you should be lighting Hanukkah candles in COVID-19 backyard minyanim, right? So minyanim that in some places where they haven't really gone back to shul, or maybe they've gone to the shul courtyard, but they're not really in the set building. Should they be lighting Hanukkah candles? And if they should light Hanukkah candles, or if they want to light Hanukkah candles even, is that up to them? And better yet, can they make brachot? Can they make is making a bracha then a bracha levatala? Or are they allowed to make brachot if they want to opt into it? Should they opt into making to lighting candles? Like, how do we view that issue? So, the first thing, let me share my screen so we get so you can look at some of the sources I have. But the first thing I will say is that this is true especially for Hanukkah candles in shul settings or in backyard minyanim or any real setting other than homes, and it's true in homes as well. But I think there's an effort to try a little harder. But the first, most important, paramount thing that anyone has to say is that fire safety is critical. And that being careful with how you're lighting and when dealing with fires, Rechonat Thunder has been like a number of like fires that like have taken place over the years in like our communities, and it's always very important to be very careful. And in shul settings, especially backyards, where there's definitely like the fear that potentially a fire could happen if you're not being careful, you don't set it up properly, that's going to override any potential obligation, especially as we'll see in a shul where the obligation to begin with is not so clear cut. So actually, let me ask this: where do you think the obligation to begin in a to light in a shul even? Where does that come from? Does anybody have any suggestions? All right. Well, there's no actual mention of shul, of any mention of lighting in a shul in any context within the Gemara, and even within like many Rishonim, within the Rambam, within the Rif, there's no mention at all of lighting in shuls. It is a minhag we do find. I think the first earlier source that I found is in the Gaonic literature. So about roughly say exactly when exactly this Gaon is writing, but around the 800s, we have testament that there is a concept of lighting in the shuls, a type of custom of lighting in shuls. If you look at source number one, they mention that Anu minhagenu, our minhag, when it comes to there's a response to a question of how we should light in the shuls or how we should light at home, and the response is that in a shul you should light Bete Knesset Osim ke Beit Hillel. In our shul settings, we light like Beit Hillel, meaning we do one candle the first night, second night we do two candles, and we keep going up, kind of similar to what we do nowadays in our own shuls. But there's like some response, some type of association with the question of how to light in shuls. But there's no real critical literature on this. Already Shibule HaLeket in source number two, I quote, who's an Italian Rishon who lived in around the 1200s, somewhere around the 1250s is probably when he published this book. When he published his sefer, it's like a collection of minhagim, collection of halachot from his teachers. He's partly stemming from Bali, from Tosfot school, and he mentions the gam anu noagim, source number two, lehadlik beit haknesset. We too, in my shul, in he lived in Rome, so in my shul in Rome, we too had the minhag to light in the shul. V'lo yadanu shoresh ve'anaf leminhag zeh. I do not know the source. I don't know the any root to this minhag. Mori Rabbi Yehuda Achi Sheni haya nimna mil hadlik shelo levarach aleha. And based on that, because this minhag has neither a source nor any precedent that we can think about, no justification legally, so actually my brother actually would avoid lighting menorahs, lighting at all, or specifically he would avoid making any brachot, because in his mind it'd be a bracha levatala to make a bracha in a shul, to light in shul and make a bracha that you're not yotzei the chiyuv. Right, and he explains why not. And I also agree with this, meaning Shmuel Aleket agrees. After every person lights in their own home, what purpose does it serve to light in a shul? If there were guests, so you can't suggest. One of the suggestions we'll see for why you should light in a shul is maybe because they're lighting for the guests, for the people who are sleeping in the shul, and that is for them their home. So his argument is like, okay, well, those people should light for themselves in their own home. The guests should light wherever they're staying in their little motel room. The kamin leach sanai chayav ben ner Chanukah. The im ein sham orchim. If there are no guests in the shul, Matzar yech lahadlik. So then why are you lighting at all? The Shemat Pneshu Veitira Ein Lahadlik. And therefore he concludes that you really should not light Ner Hanukkah candles, and you definitely should not be making any brachot. So we see already then in this early source, this, you're contending with this minhag. This isn't the only time this has happened in Jewish history, but there are this is one of the more prominent examples of where a custom has kind of crept up, become very popular among shuls, among the lay Jewry. And at some point, Rishonim, the rabbis of their generation start contending with the question of, wait, like, how do we justify this common practice? How do we justify what we're doing every day at home or in our shuls, right? What justification, what halachic, legal, normative, basis can we find for what we are doing? So Shibboleth is contending with that. He concedes that there is such a minhag, but he doesn't know why or what the source for that minhag is, what its purpose. So granted that we all do light, and this is the Psak in Shulchan Aruch, is that based on this minhag, we do light menorahs in our shuls. So the question is that we need to discover a little bit is why, what kind of is the basis for lighting in the shuls, where does this minhag, this halacha come from, and how do we relate to it then? Okay, so there are three main reasons. There are a few offshoots, but there are three main reasons you can prescribe for why you should light in a shul. What gain do you have in lighting in a shul for menorah in addition to lighting at home? So the first reason that's hinted in the Shibboleth Leket, but it's explicit in the Beit Yosef and other places. Beit Yosef, Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. So he writes as follows. He lists a bunch of reasons, and one of the reasons he lists, "Mashikatavti Shemanichin Ner Chanukah Beit HaKnesset," source number 3. "Nireh Shetiknu Kein," why do we light in the shul? "Nipnei HaOrchim," because of the guests. "She'ein Lahem Bayit Lahadlik Bo," because the guests who are in the shul, who don't have anywhere to light, they rely on the lighting in the shuls. And he says, "Kamo she'tiknu kiddush beit haKnesset." The model for this lighting is going to be similar to the recitation of kiddush and havdalah we recite also in shul, which all of that is done for mishum orchim de'achlu v'shatu beiknishta. That's all based on like an old minhag that's done for the benefit of those guests who are eating and sleeping and living really in the shuls and beimidrash, who'd roam around Europe and that was kind of like their home. So in order to fulfill the obligation for those people who are living in the shul and potentially also the guests in the town who didn't have a home, Beit Yosef prescribes that we therefore light a menorah for them on their behalf. A similar type reason, the same type of idea, that really the purpose of lighting is to fulfill the obligation of those who can't fulfill it otherwise because they don't know how to, because they don't have homes, is mentioned in the Kolbo, Kolbo is actually a Rishon. We don't actually know who exactly wrote it. It's a book that came out towards the end of the 13th century. We don't really know for sure who wrote it, so it's a little bit unclear who authorship it is. But he prescribes many different minhagim, also in Europe at the time. And he explains why do we have this minhag of Ner Chanukah in shuls? Why lehotzi mishenu baki b'sheinu zariz bezot? The purpose of lighting in a shul is to fulfill the obligation for someone who doesn't know how to do it properly, right? They didn't have a sitter in front of them. They don't know what the rules of Chanukah lighting is. And we are, therefore, we're going to be motzi them, their obligation in shul, as a commune on their behalf, so to speak. So to summarize then, the first obligation that I kind of capped together, these two slightly variant examples, I capped as one general theme, that we're lighting in a shul in order to fulfill the obligation for those who otherwise cannot, either because they have no home or because they don't know how to do it on their own. That's why we light in a shul. That became the minhag. The second reason that we light in a shul is something which is a slightly different reason. This is source number 5. The Kolbo mentions this. Again, the same source, the Kolbo. He mentions another reason. V'negu kol mekom, why do we light? V'zecher lemikdash. That lighting in a shul is meant to be some type of symbol, some type of remembrance for the lighting in the Beit HaMikdash, right? Something which for Hanukkah makes a lot of sense, right? Part of the story of Hanukkah is not only the battle that the Maccabim beat the Yevanim, right? Not only that the few beat the many, but also part of the miracle they remember specifically is the miracle of the lights, that the one jug of oil lasted for 8 nights. So it makes a lot of sense then that we're not going to only associate to that miracle by lighting Chanukiot in our own home, but we're also going to light a Chanukah menorah in the shul setting in order to remember, to remind us like of the original menorah, which also was in a Beit Mikdash. And the shul, as we know, is a Beit Mikdash Me'at. The shul setting itself is meant to remind us of the Beit Mikdash. It's supposed to be some type of miniaturized communal setting, symbolizing the same ideas. And therefore, it's very fitting that on Chanukah of all holidays, we do something specifically in shul to commemorate what happened in the Beit Mikdash. So that would be reason number two, potentially, for lighting in a shul setting. The third reason, okay, that's probably the most popular reason, probably the reason that most people like immediately jump to, is that what's significant about a shul is that it's a very public affair, right? It's a communal gathering point. If anything, I'd say COVID years make this feels like this very, this feels very true, and in fact, it is very absent, that we can't gather publicly in the same way we usually do because of the pandemic. But the shul setting really is meant to be the communal center. And therefore, it like makes a lot of sense when we think about why we light in the shul, because the shul, therefore, is the best place to publicize the miracle. It's the most public place. It's where everyone gathers. And that's what the Meiri, among others, Meiri is a 12th century, 13th century rishon who lived in Provence in France. He mentions, V'zen neshenag v'ladlikim, source number 6, Beit Knesset, ikar ha'inyan mishum pirsumei nisa. The main reason why we light in a shul is because pirsumei nisa, it's a way of publicizing the miracle. It's a public setting. It's how we spread out the word that of Hanukkah to the most people at one time. All right, so we have three, therefore, basic reasons for why we should light Hanukkah lights in a shul, or what the minhag is meant to commemorate, what this purpose is. First, it's meant to fulfill what really should be an obligation fulfilled at home, but we do something in shul to serve the benefit of others who can't fulfill it for their own, for whatever reason, in their own homes, either because they don't know how to, or because they don't have homes actively, because they're guests, they're travelers, they're visitors from foreign places, they don't have homes, and they can't fulfill the obligation as they should in their home. That's reason number one. Reason two, it's supposed to be some type of zecher lamikdash, some type of symbol for the Beit HaMikdash, right? Just as the menorah plays a central role in Hanukkah, so too we symbolize that menorah through our own mikdash me'at in our synagogues. And thirdly, third potential reason is that the lighting in a shul is meant to publicize, it's a very public affair, and it's the best way of really spreading the word that tonight is Hanukkah, and everyone should know about it. All right, those are the three main reasons that we light Hanukkah candles in shuls. Three explanations. Any questions thus far? Great. So there's some interesting before as we kind of explore this idea, because I want to really flesh out some of these different explanations and how they interact with each other. The best way to do that is what's called it's what's called nafka minot, kind of these test cases where through like specific questions we're able to really flesh out some of these different reasons and how they interact with each other, and you know how to really, it really helps us, enables us to better understand each of these reasons. So I want to present two different nafka minot, and then we'll kind of move on and go back to our specific case of the COVID lighting with this better understanding, this better lens to understanding it. So one nafka minot, one test case to really understand the difference between some of these reasons is a question that appears in Rishonim and Achronim already, as where do we place the menorah in the shul? Right, so I want to light the menorah, so I know in my house, the best place to light the menorah in my house is supposed to be the place which is most public, near the entrance, somewhere where people can be seen the most. It's actually like a whole big discussion nowadays, like because our homes aren't built the same way and it's colder and we're afraid of thieves. It's actually not like necessarily the most chatchila option, but we do nowadays in our own homes. But we do what we do in home, and we know where we put our menorahs. But where we put in shul, right? Where is the best ideal location to put your menorah in shul? So In the Rishonim, you can see already some discussion about this. So the Tur quotes the source. The Tur being the son of the Rush in 14th century Spain, writes as follows: Uveita Knesset Manicha leDarom Zecher leMenorah Shaita veDarom. He says you put the menorah on the southern wall of the shul as a remembrance of the menorah in Beit HaMikdash, which it too was put on the southern wall of the Beit HaMikdash of the Heichal. Okay, so that's one explanation. You should put it on the southern wall. That's answer number one. The Darkei Moshe, the Ramah, commenting on this, it says, haminagim. That's what other minhagim in Ashkenaz, that's what people in Poland do. Delo kiminhag berain, as opposed to the minhag in Rhine, meaning in Germany, shahayu noagim lahamidan bitzafon li smola chazan. That in Germany, the minhag was to put the menorah in shul on the north side, to the left of the chazan. Right? So the chazan is facing east. So left of the chazan, right, if you have your cardinal directions in front of you, left of east is going to be north. So you should put it to the north. Now, what's significant about the north? Why should you put menorah on the north? So here's why you should put it on the north. And this, I think, emerges better when you look at the Shibboleth HaLeket to understand what this different minhagim is. So the Shibboleth HaLeket we saw earlier is a collection of a lot of minhagim that appears a student of Bali Tosfot. He writes as follows. These are different minhagim about Hanukkah. About where to place the menorah. Sorry. Source number 9. Katav bala dibrot. Nagu lahadlik ner chanukah beta knesset. We should have the minhag put it in the shul. Ve'yesh mikomot. So where do you put it? Shenagu lanicha ala petach. So one custom is to put it at the entrance of the shul. Right? So in the lobby of the shul, that's where you should put the menorah. That's option number 1. 2, he mentions. Ve'yesh shemenachim oto be'emsa beta knesset. The other option is to put it right in the middle. Like right where nowadays most, B motar, that's where you should put the menorah. Right? So how do we understand these different positions? We have one position of the southern wall. We have one position of the entrance of the shul. And we have one position that should be right in the middle of the shul. Right in the smack in the middle. Right? How do we understand each of these different positions? So I would suggest that each of these positions, that where you should put the menorah, reflects why you think you should light the menorah to begin with. If you think that the purpose of lighting the menorah is in order to be a zecher lamikdash, to commemorate what happened in the Beit HaMikdash, right? Because you believe that the main purpose of writing in the shul is to commemorate the miracle that happened in the Beit HaMikdash, and the shul is a mikdash me'at. That's the main purpose. So it makes sense that you're going to want to mimic to the best of your ability what happened in the Beit HaMikdash. And so just as in the Beit HaMikdash, right, in the temple, the menorah is placed on the southern wall. So too, you're going to want to put the menorah in a shul on the southern wall, right? You're going to want to mimic it to the best of your ability. And that's what the Torah says explicitly, that it's zecher menorah shaiteh bet darom, that the minhag is based on exactly what happened in the Beit HaMikdash. If though you think that the purpose of putting the menorah is not what I labeled as a different reason, is based on the fact that you want to publicize the miracle, right? Because the shul is the best gathering place. It's the place where the most people are gathered. So where is the best place to put the menorah? So I'd argue, where is the most public place? Right in the middle, right? Where everyone can see it, right? Smack in where the chazan stands, where the bima is, right? In most shuls, that's right in the middle. That's the most public place. That's where everyone can see the menorah. And everyone can participate and enjoy and really publicize the miracle. And that's exactly what Shmuel HaLeket suggests, that one of the minhagim was to put be'emsa beit haknesset. If though you take the third position, what I call actually position 1, which is that the purpose of the Hanukkah candle, of lighting in a shul, is because the lighting is meant to fulfill the obligation for those who can't fulfill it otherwise, right, who would like to fulfill their obligation, but they can't for whatever reason, because they're guests or because they don't know how to, so then it makes sense that the menorah should be placed to the best possible way that they would do it in their own homes. And so where are you supposed to put a menorah in your home? By the entrance, by the petach. And so therefore, where does the Shibboleth HaLeket suggest that some people had the minhag to put the menorah? In the entrance of the shul. Shenagu lanicha ala petach. Because the point of the menorah is to best mimic the practices of doing it in your home, since the purpose of menorah in the shul is to fulfill the obligation for those who can't on their own. Okay, so I hope, if that's clear, that these three positions we see about where to place menorah: one, in the middle of the shul; two, by the entrance of the shul; and three, by the southern wall. Each of these three positions of where to place the menorah reflects a different position on what the purpose of lighting menorah in shul to begin with is. If it's about publicizing the miracle, you're going to want to put it in the middle of the shul, most public. If it's about being zecher lamikdash, remembering the mikdash story, you want to put it exactly like the mikdash, mimic the mikdash as best as possible, and put it on the southern wall. And if it's about fulfilling the obligation of Hanukkah for those who can't, then you're going to want to put it by the entrance, just like you do at a regular in a home. Everyone clear so far? Now, something that's very worthwhile mentioning is what is the minhag nowadays? What do we do in most shuls? And I think this, I have never been to a shul not this way, and this is like, as far as I know, Shulchan Aruch passing this way, and this is normative halacha in, I'd say, at least 99% of Orthodox shuls. Where do we put the menorah? We pass and we put it on the western, we put it on the southern wall. We pass in like the tour that we put the menorah, zecher, the mikdash, as a remembrance to the mikdash. Right, so I want you to keep that in mind, that we end up paskening with regard to the question about where to place the menorah. We follow the ruling of the Torah that we care about is the reasoning of Zecher LaMikdash. And we'll get back to that point in a little bit later. But that's of the three positions, that's the one with regard to this issue, which we end up taking, which we end up what the consensus ends up holding like. Okay, that's what I call nafkamina number one. A second nafkamina, which will lead us more directly into our question here in a little bit, is a second test case, is what happens if you light without a minyan? And I'll tell you what the case where this comes up a lot. There's a general rule, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, when should you light the menorah in general, like just tonight, for instance, when should they have lit the menorah in shul? So the general minhag is, this is the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, my source number 10, v'noagim lahalik v'yedak neset bein mincha l'mariv. The minhag is to light the candles between mincha and maariv right before maariv begins, before you kind of begin the next day officially through maariv. That's when you light the menorah. The question is, what happens on erev Shabbos? Erev Shabbos, of course, there are several different issues, but one of which is going to be a problem of we're worried that if we wait too long to light the menorah, right? We wait to light menorah after mincha, so a lot of shuls they start late, right? So you might schedule mincha for 4:10. But, you know, at the end of the day, mincha sometimes like starts a little bit late, especially erev Shabbos. People are preparing their meals or food. All right. I mean, I'll tell you honestly, like, I almost consistently come late to mincha on erev Shabbos. It's hard not to. You take a shower, you're always running. It's not great, but that's what ends up happening. And so shul starts a little tardy, starts a little bit late. And sometimes mincha, there isn't much time between when mincha ends and when Shabbos starts. So if you wait for the very last minute to light menorah only at the end of mincha, then you're going to run a problem of lighting Hanukkah menorah when Shabbos starts. So partly based on that reason, there may be other concerns as well, but partly based on that reason, some people suggest that you should light before mincha begins. And that way you prevent this problem because the shamash, some responsible member of the shul, the gabbai, will come before shul and light menorah then. And that way you avoid this problem of potentially lighting or having to light right before Shabbos begins and not having enough time to do it. That's some people's suggestion. And it runs the following problem. You can see the Shulchan Aruch mentions this, Vishnoagim Lahadlik Be'er Shabbat Kodem Mincha, that's the Minhag. But the Mishnah Brura says that, he thinks that's not Lechat Chila, but he mentions that that's fine to do. If you have no other choice, better you do that and you make the Bracha. But there's the following objection which is raised. This is why I'm bringing this up. Because the Moruksia, the Rav Yaakov Emden, 18th century Achron, living in Poland, presented the following objection, which was that, in his view, the problem with lighting too early, right, before Mincha, was that there weren't sometimes enough people there, right? If you light before Mincha, who's there in the shul? So the gabbai's there, and the people who are, you know, yekim, and the people who come to shul early on time, and maybe a few other people who are particularly studious and good at coming on time to mincha on Erev Shabbos. But a lot of people won't be there, and you might not necessarily have a minyan. And the Moruksia, the Yaakov Emden points out that he thinks that you cannot make a bracha in shul if there is no minyan. Right? He says in source number 12, V'nira de'al kol panim, ein lehadik bibracha, in ein sham asar bebeit haKnesset. You cannot make a bracha in a shul setting if there are not 10 men. And he says, v'karov b'nai shehi bracha levatala. And I think not only can you not make a bracha, but it's even a bracha levatala. I'm willing so far to say that it's actually formally a bracha levatala. He really thinks to the farthest end that it's a bracha levatala, you cannot make the bracha then. So how do we understand these different views? Right? Can you light menorah without a minyan? Can you light before people are there or not? Right, how do we understand that? So the precise machlok between Mishnah Berurah and Moruksia is on a slightly different issue. I don't want to address exactly what they're dealing with, but the general position of their views, and their views are reflecting on other Rishonim and other Achronim as well, reflects different positions about how we view the purpose of lighting a menorah on in a shul to begin with. If you think, right, let's go back to our three positions. If you think that the purpose of lighting the shul, lighting in a shul setting, is for the guests, for the people who don't know how to read or how to highlight on their own, so then in theory, there's no real need for a minyan. All you need maybe is someone who hasn't lit before, or maybe you have to have some nominal concern for the general public, but you don't necessarily need a full minyan. You don't necessarily need a formal organization of people, a formal community members. Because all that matters is just you have some people, because the point of the lighting is for the general public who's going to see the menorah, who haven't lit on their own, and they're going to see the lighting when it comes, they come late to shul, they're going to see it, and that's going to be good enough for them. If though you think that the lighting, likewise, if you think that the purpose of lighting in shul is that it's supposed to be zecher lamikdash, supposed to commemorate what happened in the Beit HaMikdash. So let me ask you, in the Beit HaMikdash, how many people saw the lighting in the Heichal? How many people were there? Right, the Kohen, or potentially the Kohen would go and light the menorah. How many people were there? No one. There was no one else there with him. And maybe there were a few Kohanim at most, but it was really empty. There definitely was no minyan in the room where he was lighting the menorah yet. And yet it was still significant on its own. So there's no reason, if you think that it's Zecher LaMikdash, that you necessarily need a formal minyan in lighting the menorah in a shul setting either. Now, according to the third reason, though, if it's about Pirsumei Nisa, it's about having a public gathering, it's the most public way of performing the miracle, so then it makes a lot of sense then that you're going to want to have, at least potentially, you're going to necessitate that there be a minyan present, to be a group of people present when you make the brachot, when you actually do the lighting. So each of these three reasons then matches up well to whether or not you'd light with a minyan. If you think it's about either if you think it's about Deir HaMikdash, or if you think it's about lighting on behalf of other people, you might not need a formal minyan. If it's about though, if it's about create making a Pirsumei Nisa, making a public gathering, then you're going to want to light with a minyan. The reason I mentioned this particular argument, this is going to lead us to the exact next point, is I want to mention that there is a slight twist to this, which is that not only might you need like a minyan, meaning of 10 men present, but Rav Schechter quotes Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and it's worth some research here. I'm not going to read it inside, but he quotes Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who argues that not only do you potentially need a minyan, meaning a group of 10 men, but you need what he calls a tzibur. You need a organization, you need a group of 10 men who have done something to become formally defined as a tzibur, as a community. They have to have done some Jewish, some halachic tefillah, some type of davening, some type of formal exercise, some type of formal ritual, sorry, formal ritual where they've now defined themselves as a community. So he thinks, for instance, that you need to have Daven Mincha or Maariv together. But if you haven't done anything together, then you cannot be, then even having 10 people is not sufficient to be able to light. So for instance, he particularly rails against here at the end of the source, America, what many people in America do, Chanukah, Shalha men's club, that there are people light Chanukah candles at men's clubs. I'm not sure exactly what he's referring, maybe the local JCC is what he's talking about. Oh, misibat or at parties like a bat mitzvahs or weddings. So nire al pi pashtut. It seems to me that this is not like the original minhag, and it's the bracha levatala. Because not only in his view do you need to have 10 men present, but you need to have of what's called a formalized group of people, which is called a tzibur, a community, which is only defined through having perform some type of ritual service together, like davening together, mincha or maariv. That's Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's approach. So all of this then takes us to this next question, which was really this directly into the COVID-19 question, which is a very public issue, comes up a lot every year almost, but we don't really start to think about it as like a controversial issue, which is can you light at a public event? So this is perhaps most famous among Chabad, right? I'm not sure what the Chabad at Plainview does, But Chabad definitely, where I am, I'm right now in Manhattan. So Chabad's in Manhattan throughout. They find these huge public areas like Times Square, and they light these huge menorahs, and they make brachot for the people around them. Right? Is that allowed? Is that permissible? Can you do? Is it something desirable? And is something even permissible? Can you make those brachot? Right, so based on the reasons we've expressed so far about shuls, you're able to then extract, and this is the way that the Achronim approach the issue, you're able to extract what your position should be on any public event, should you be able to make brachot. Right, so if you think, for instance, that the purpose of if you think, for instance, the purpose of making the brachot is that there's supposed to be some type of zecher lemikdash, some type of remembrance for what happened in the Beit HaMikdash, right? So then there's very little room to suggest that in a public sphere there's like a Zecher LaMikdash, right? I understand that the Young Israel of Plainview is like it's a respectable shul, so of course that's going to be something that symbolizes the Beit HaMikdash, but like why should Times Square in any ways like mimic the Beit HaMikdash? That's not anyways obvious, and there's no reason to suggest that Times Square is supposed to mimic the Beit HaMikdash. So according to that argument, there's no way you should be lighting in Times Square with brachot. And in fact, that's what a lot of Achronim, if you look at Source 14, I quoted Minchat Yitzchak. He's like an Achron who died in the just recently in the who lives in the 20th century. Who was the head of the Eda Haredi in Yerushalayim. So he answers on this question, and his answer is mimicked by a lot of very famous Gedolim. You can look at Rav Eliashiv and Rav and Netziv Eliezer and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. They all express the same type of response, which is that here I'll look at source number 14. Hinei kama dachkor botenu mistotama bracha zo bita knesset. Already the rabbis, this is a totally different topic, but making a bracha at all in a shul, as we mentioned, is kind of a little bit difficult. It's not very obvious where that source is. And therefore, and therefore, since it's already a chiddush, it's already so novel and unintuitive that you can make a bracha at all, even in a shul setting. So how are we possibly extending this big chiddush, this big novelty, to outside settings, something that our forefathers did not do? How can we make new minhagim that break the boundaries of what our forefathers did? And he adds in addition some type of theological argument that he also disagrees with, like the actual gathering. He doesn't think it's a healthy gathering. Some type of theological hashkafic argument he adds at the end there too, but the main argument is that we have no minhag for this. We barely can justify putting it in shul, so how can we possibly justify extending it and making new minhagim to light outside of shuls, outside and to light in Times Square, or light even at a bar mitzvah or a wedding or anything of the sort. On the other hand, though, there are those who would argue that you could light in these settings, but maybe under certain qualifications. So one qualification potentially is you look at source number 15, the Mikra Kodesh, who's a 20th century Achron, again, who kind of compendium of different halachot for holidays. He says as follows in source 15: Im netzvu nashim la'aseret misibat chag chatuna v'kadomeh. People are there for a public gathering, and under the condition that umitpalim sham mincha v'arvit b'minyan, if they are davening mincha and maariv in a minyan, notar lahem la'dlik sham neror Chanukah bibracha mishum pirsum hanes. Then for those people, they can light Hanukkah candles because of pirsum hanes. Now, what position does this reflect? Why, according to this view, can you light in at a wedding? Just because you daven mincha, why should you daven at a wedding? So, as I mentioned, it can't be that you believe it's because lighting is based on the concept that it's a mikdash me'at. That doesn't make sense, because a wedding hall also is not in any ways representative of the Beit HaMikdash. But what it is, though, it's a public gathering place, right? Our wedding, especially pre-COVID, a lot of weddings are almost 300, 400 people. Just a few weeks ago, I believe in Williamsburg, there was a wedding of, Sommers had a wedding of like 15,000 people. Or 7,000, 15,000, I think it's 15,000 people. It's a crazy huge gathering. It's definitely there, be a lot of pirsum hanes. And the argument they make is that if you, as long as you have the formal minyan, you have the technical requirement that you've created tzibur through davening, now you'd be allowed to then light Hanukkah candles and fulfill this obligation of Pirsum Hanes. There is a third position, right, which reflects kind of the third possible view of what the reasoning for Hanukkah lighting in shuls is, and it as follows. Some people permit it even if there are no mitpalim, if there are no people who are there who are davening any minyanim. And the explanation there in the footnote, in footnote 23, is why is that true? Because kevan sheish baze pirsum hanes v'chein yeshnam sham harbe anashim she'enam shomrim Torah u'mitzvot ve'enam madlakim klal ner Chanukah. The reason you're allowed to light in a shul set in a wedding, even if you're not davening, is because a lot of people there are not necessarily sort of observant. They might not. There might be the poss. There's a fair possibility that at least one person is not lighting Hanukkah candles on their own, and therefore, by lighting in a public setting, you are somehow fulfilling their mitzvah on their behalf. It may be bidyevet. It may not be the ideal way of their fulfilling their obligation, but you're doing something on their behalf, and that's going to be permissible there and maybe even laudable to then light in this public setting. All right, so we see already in this question about lighting at public events, non shul settings, right, at Times Square or at a wedding, we see these three positions kind of reflected. We see the position of the mikdash. If we care about that the shul has to, that only in settings which are like the Beit HaMikdash we can light, then of course it should be forbidden. And that's the way that a lot of Acharonim position themselves. If you think, though, it's about Pirsum HaNeis, the most public gathering, so then you're going to think, oh, maybe I could really do it in public, especially if there's a minyan, because there's a formal sibur. But maybe even if not, if you don't really hold or necessitate a formal sibur, which is what certainly what Chabad believes. Or the third possibility, which is possible, which we saw just now, that it could be you're lighting not because of necessarily only because of the public gathering, but also because you're fulfilling the obligation for someone else. Because of those guests, because of those people who don't know how to light on their own, because of those people, for whatever reason, they're not going to light their own Hanukkah candles, and they want to fulfill the mitzvah on their behalf. All right, so nowadays, so this is a question that comes up almost every year, right, about lighting at public events, and Chabad obviously has one view. I think most modern Orthodox shuls have a different view. They don't tend to light publicly, which maybe speaks to our own outreach programming, but also maybe speaks to our halachic position on the particular problem, on a particular issue. But that's generally the way we view this issue. Now we come to our question, to lighting at a Corona backyard minyan. And so I ask you, based on what we've discussed so far, what would your reflection be on a backyard minyan? On the one hand, right, a backyard minyan is a public gathering as well, right? It's a gathering which at least has 10 men. It has a davening setting, right? So it fulfills this formal requirement of having davening. You could argue not only is it having davening, but it's, in fact, it's a more kavua davening. It's not just that most backyard minyanim are like a one-time event, but they've really been happening already for months now, right? They've been going on for almost half, for over half a year of just these outdoor minyanim that are consistently happening, right? The court minyan in Young Israel Plainview has been happening for quite a long time. So there's definitely a lot to say that if you think already that public events should generally be lighting, so of course you should be able to light and make a bracha even in backyard minyan for COVID. If you think though, if you take the position of the mikdash me'at, that what matters to you though is that you think that really what's important is that only the shul is allowed because it's a place which symbolizes Beit HaMikdash, and non-shul settings are not allowed because there's no presentation of Beit HaMikdash. So the question then becomes, how do we view courtyards? How do we view backyard minyanim? How much of our backyard minyanim, of the shul's courtyards, the shul's parking lot, how would we view that in terms of formal Beit HaKnesset? And I think in some ways the jury's still a little bit out on that question. It's I think most people would assume that we're not really at the same point as the Mikdash Me'at. Mikdash Me'at tends to be more permanent. There tends to be a full Aron Kodesh that tends to be there permanently. It's dug into the ground potentially, or it's like set up permanently. It's attached to the wall. It's not something which is moved back and forth every day. The chairs are set up more permanently, but it's not so clear. I saw some tshuva that I saw Rav Rimon in Israel at one of the Shiva Har Tzion. He thinks that actually that now that most Chronomen would be more kavua, would be more set up. But I quoted at the very end, Rav Schechter, who actually believes they're not. He has a Chronos shoot he's published recently, and he thinks it's not set up in a shul setting. Rav Weissman. All right. Well, there's a lot of issues there. It's a very packed question. I think I have. Let me say it this way. I think it's an interesting question. I think if you ask like Rav Rimon, position, I can. If you want to look, I'll send you where he writes it. He writes it based on an article Rav Lichtenstein makes, and it's not actually. I'm not. I actually don't like his proof so much. I think Rav Lichtenstein points about chayalim, about soldiers who are like camped out in like the you know in the desert or whatever. And whether their home is now established by where they're set if they're set there for 30 days. He then tries, or Ramon tried then paralleling that to a shul setting. I'm not sure that's a fair comparison, but he thinks that is a fair comparison, and therefore he thinks that in some ways that the shul courtyard really should be considered, at least for Hanukkah lighting, a shul. And maybe your parallel of the Magen Avot would be true. Although with regard to your last question, I would say I'm not sure that the Tanai, whether going backwards will be the same problem. Modeling the Kodesh should apply if it's like based on the Tanai, since it's like everyone knows that the courtyard's a temporary thing. Everyone like the you only establish the courtyard as a Beit Knesset to all Tanai that you'd go back once Corona ended. Like that was your original thought. No one like established the courtyard as like a full minyan forever. So I would assume that there would Milan Kodesh wouldn't apply in the same way there. But I think it's an interesting question. But either way, I would argue though, and I think Rav Schechter definitely takes this position, that I'm not sure that the rules for Magen Avot and what's called the minyan kavua with regard to let's say Magen Avot apply the same way when you talk about a shul with regard to certain halachot of shuls, and especially for Hanukkah. Or what we're interested here is not necessarily what's considered a kavua minyan. We're not interested in what's considered to be a tzibur kavua or the communal gathering place, which is kavua, which could be anywhere in the world. We're interested is what is defined formally as a Beit Knesset, as a place which mimics the Beit Mikdash as best as possible. And therefore, I'd argue that there has to be not only there has to be a regular gathering place, but it has to be really dedicated as a shul, somewhere that there has been like a dedicated Sefer Torah, a dedicated Aron. To the shul, something that, you know, maybe it's a tax write-off on it already, specifically for that location, right? There has to be formal things which designate this location as a shul, even for Ner Hanukkah. So to wrap up, and this is really, if you look at, there's actually, I was looking recently, just like today and yesterday, onto what people actually think practically, what you should do for these minyanim. So I thought it really comes down to which po what post can believe is an important issue for lighting Hanukkah candles and shuls to begin with. If you think it's about, if you're one of those poskim who thinks you're pretty matir on lighting in any public sphere, right? Lighting at weddings, lighting at like Chabad. So then, of course, why shouldn't you extend to light anywhere you want? Like, of course, you should light it in a backyard. And like, maybe you don't have to, but definitely there's like, definitely there's something good in doing so, and therefore you should make a bracha on doing so. Like, gezunt heit, like, please, the more lighting, the better, the more pirsumei nisa, the better. Everything's great. If, though, you take the position, and that's likewise true if you think it's about if it's about the guests and the people who can't light on their own. So maybe in a shul setting, it should be similar to lighting in it should be probably pretty similar to lighting in a shul regularly, where you light for people who can't light on their own. But if you think what matters is the mikdash me'at, this formal requirement of requiring a Beit Mikdash, so I think as I said, the jury is a little bit out whether or not a backyard minyan is really a Beit Mikdash me'at. But the way that like Rav Schechter and other poskim seem to contend is that it's really not. We require the formal building, and we don't have that. And then the question becomes, which of these three factors do we care about? And Rav Schechter thinks that we care about the Mikdash Me'at question, that we care about the fact that the Beit HaMikdash Me'at, and the proof to that question may be to the point, as I mentioned, if you remember back like almost 25 minutes ago, I mentioned that where do we place the menorah, right? Where do the men of the minhagim, where are many of the customs we do with regard to where you light the menorah, how you light the menorah in shul? A lot of it comes, and this is like widespread, a lot of it stems from what we do in the Beit HaMikdash. We put the menorah on the southern wall, Zechel HaMikdash, so they put it in the Mikdash, and therefore it seems like we tend to paskin, like we tend to hold of the position that we care about the Mikdash, and since the courtyard of the shul is not the Mikdash, we should not make a bracha, we shouldn't be lighting at all in shul settings. That's Rav Schechter's position. Take it or leave it. That's each monorthodox post they can decide on their own, you know, which position they think is the most convincing, most compelling of the three main takes. This is the way that they've approached it. And as I mentioned, to wrap up from the beginning, I'll mention that the first main criteria, of course, especially in backyard minyanim, is going to be safety. If you can't light safely, then of course, you should not light, Hanukkah candle, especially since it's only a minog, it's not worth the risk. That's the first thing, but it really will come down to how we deal with these three issues. Three issues being, how do we view, Hanukkah candles? Is it based on, lighting for other people who can't light for themselves, like guests or, people who don't know how to light? Is it about, Zecher LeMikdash, trying to remember it's for the Mikdash? Or is it about, presuming Nisa, expanding the miracle and the lighting for as many people as possible? Based on these three different perspectives, as we saw, you're going to relate to the mitzvah in different ways. You're going to relate to, therefore, how you should light in different ways, where you should light, and whether you can light in backyard minyanim as well as in public places like Times Square or at weddings. All right, that's my take. Thank you for listening, and any questions if anybody has. Yeah, question.